Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast, number 30 as well, which seems like a bit of a milestone. Joining me today is not Bruno. He is not joining me today. The reason being he's on the piss. He's seen that Nathan Ferguson is on the bench for the under 21s. He's absolutely loving life. He wasn't going to be here anyway. Let's be real. Let's be real. But joining me today is nonetheless world-class Fabrizio Romano tier certified TalkSport reporter Bobby Manzi. How are you doing, Bobby?
Thanks for the intro. I'm well, yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Just got back from the airport, so I'm a little bit knackered, but not too bad. I had a good time. Just before I introduce Liam, of course, I should say reintroduce. Just tell us a bit about your gig on TalkSport, because we have to address it. Come on, really good stuff, mate. But how did that come about? What was it like being on TalkSport?
Yeah, no, it was good fun. I've been on there a couple of times this season on the late show, and for some reason they decided to take the risk and move me up to their prime time slot, which was quite enjoyable. It was the first time I've ever done it live. Normally we do it pre-recorded, but it was really fun. It was a different having the experience, having your camera on and having to broadcast in that kind of sense. But it was super enjoyable.
Yeah, it was a really good segment. And of course, if you haven't seen it already, please head over to TalkSport and give it a watch. I've kind of shuffled the deck as it compared to what I normally do. So, without further ado, obviously, I'm delighted to welcome you back, Liam, which again, I feel like I've done what I did last time, which is kind of set up someone really well and then just kind of shoehorn the other in. So, yeah, I've kind of repaid the favour here. But nonetheless, really good to have you back, mate. How are you been?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm good. You balanced it after last week, and good to shine some light on Bobby getting on the getting on the big time.
Didn't even plug the pod. What a cheeky
Whoa, whoa, whoa! They
cunt.
did plug it. They did plug it. They said, "Crystal Palace reporter at Vavel and the Palace Way."
I missed that completely. I must have not been listening. You know what I'm like with you, Bobby. I've zoned out somehow. Funny that. No, jokes aside, really good stuff, guys. But nonetheless, we have to move on. Unfortunately, as I predicted on our last episode, we left pie-faced. I think we were quite optimistic going to the Spurs game. We had a couple of 2-2 shouts. Bobby, you were running away with it, considering that we were going to
Yeah, I
win.
was 2-0, wasn't I?
Yeah, a very commendable 2-0. But nonetheless, we are here
To be
discussing.
fair, when we went 1-0 up, I said to the guy we was with in the ground, I say the guy I was with, my dad I went to the game with. So I said to dad in the ground that we would either go on to win 2-0 or we'd lose 3-1.
Okay, fine. Hold my hands up. We got there in the end. Another Eze wonder strike to discuss. It feels like it's fairly routine every time he steps onto a ball, but unfortunately, plenty of negatives as well. Nonetheless, we'll be looking at that in some detail. But of course, there's a lot of news outside the club too. We've got news on Cheick Doucouré to discuss. We've got news on some pretty interesting quotes from John Textor. So plenty to unpack, and obviously delighted to have you lads here with me today. But just going into the Spurs game, obviously we just touched there briefly on some expectations, but there was some unfortunate news, of course, in that Mark Gay, who was expected to be nearing a return, has now elected to have surgery. Bobby, seeing as you're now our global reporter on the scene everywhere all the time, you can tell me a bit more about that surgery.
Yeah, so as I understand it, he would have been okay to come back into the squad. He started to feel it a little bit more, but they still thought it had been all right, and he probably could have got through the season. But the real risk for him was going into the Euros, and a problem could arise that that knee would go again, and it would see him out for that. So he elected to have the surgery. Him and the club took the decision. They thought the surgery would be the best course to give him the best chance to be starting alongside John Stones at Euro 2024 in Germany.
No, it's a real shame, but obviously, I think at a personal level, I think we can empathise with why he wanted to do it. Obviously, it's really important to him that he's part of the England setup, and he's got the chance to be in his best shape for it.
I think as well, it's really good for Palace. Him being in that England setup, especially if he does start alongside John Stones, because you're talking about a player. It's no secret that Palace will sell him, whether that's next season, whether that's in 2 years, 3 years. So if he's England's number two centre back, or sorry, England's starting centre back alongside John Stones, that's a value thing, right? It adds more value onto his what you can demand of him for a transfer fee.
Absolutely. I think in the long term, I think it's a decision that will benefit everyone and obviously prevents the risk of similar sort of injuries being aggravated as well if there's something that can be nipped in the bud. But yeah, otherwise it's a really good bit of news personally because I think it at least gives him the best possible chance of getting into back into England. But we should be seeing him before the end of the season, which is something that was a little bit encouraging. So definitely one to watch there. Going into the game, I mean, Liam, I'll bring you in here. I mean, was it a bit of a free hit? I mean, we know the sort of football, and you've touched on it before, that Ange likes to play. It was always a tough ask going to a stadium that we know too well at against a style of football that's incredibly ambitious.
So I think it was a free hit in terms of the result, but I think the performance was still really important. It obviously wasn't as good as a performance as we saw against Burnley. but I think that's to be expected. But I don't think any realistic Palace fans were, going to Tottenham thinking that, we desperately needed a win. But I think we showed some fight, and I think, as much as the result was frustrating and the way we lost was particularly annoying, I didn't come away from Saturday feeling particularly frustrated. I don't know about you guys. I can only speak for myself.
I don't know. I think there was frustration there for me, because I think it was, I don't think it was the fact Palace lost the game. I think it was the way they lost the game. What that I took problem with. I thought there were some very naive decisions tactically, and I thought some of the substitutions were quite poor. And I think ultimately that cost Palace. I think at 1-0 up against a team like Spurs, what you've got to do is you've just got to go for it a bit more, because they don't like it when teams get in their faces. So I think if Palace would have pushed a bit more, I'm not saying Spurs wouldn't have scored, but I certainly think if Palace would have pushed and looked to get a second, even if they didn't score that second, I think the game would have been 1-1 rather than losing 3-1 the way they did, by sitting back and letting Spurs come to them and just take the game to them and ultimately blow them away.
No, definitely. I mean, let's just talk briefly about a big positive, which was the return of Berruyer. I mean, you mentioned it just briefly there, but we have to talk about the wonder strike. We have to talk about the fact that he was included in the lineup. Glasner didn't really shuffle the pack too much, other than maybe dropping Edouard for Eze, which felt like a pretty sensible decision from the get-go. But just in terms of his individual performance right from the start to his free kick, he wasn't overly impressive, was he? He looked quite lethargic. Welby, what did you make of that?
Yeah, no, I didn't think he played great at all. I thought he struggled to get into the game. I thought he struggled to make an impact. But, the goal he scored was invaluable at the time. It was a brilliant strike. He done well to win the free kick, and he took it excellently. So in a game like that, if Eze can provide you that, that's all you need, really.
No, definitely. One thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, Liam, was, fans obviously put a lot of pressure on Eze generally. He's our talisman. He's, well, a talisman's maybe a stretch, but he's certainly a vital player. He's kind of the poster boy for the club in terms of the project. In terms of his personal development, it's very much aligned with that at the clubs as well. Both of them have, by and large, had their rough patches, but they've enjoyed a recent ascent. And, he's definitely no exception to that. So what I really want to know is, do you think we were putting too much expectation on him having returned from injury? Because we know he generally has taken in the past a lot of time to get going.
I don't know if we put too much expectation on him this time round, purely because we played well last week. It wasn't like we were expecting him to step in and be the Messiah, which is what we were expecting under Roy. It would be miserable, miserable, miserable. Ebbs would come back, and all of a sudden we'd have a bit of hope. And I don't think that was the case at all, because obviously we played so well against Burnley. I think the expectation this time round was to see, an improvement in terms of his fit in comparison to versus Edouard in that position. I think it was, we were all pretty much expecting him to benefit the team more than Edouard did. And to be honest, I think, I don't know if he really did. Obviously, the goal was excellent, but you put that to one side. And it's exactly what you say. He does come in rusty, he does take a few games to get back up to speed. But when he can be as good as he can be, you allow that. And especially in a game like versus Spurs, in terms of the placement in the table, it is. It's not, like I said before, it's not a free hit, but you expect a loss most of the time, and it's about the performance. So I think this was a good game to bring him in, to see his sort of defensive side of things in this new system. And it was, it was a mixed bag, because the goal was so excellent.
I mean, let's just go on with that, Liam. I mean, talk to me about how Eze wins the foul and talk about the free kick itself.
Well, the free kicks. Sorry, boys, I'm going to start that again because my dog's humping my leg.
I kind of want to keep that in the edit, but.
He's just randomly, he's been sat next to me the entire time, and he's just randomly started humping my leg. And I couldn't not break. Sorry. Alex, can you ask me the question again, mate? And I'll respond.
Well, speaking of, things of a sexual nature, talk to me about that goal, Liam.
I mean, the goal was excellent, man. It was really impressive, and it feels like it's been a while since we've seen Palace score from a direct free kick. I mean, obviously there was Elise versus Man United, but they're few and far between. But it was really impressive, and I think we did see a little bit of Glasner's set piece expertise. We did put that little three man wall on the side that Ebbs swung it towards, and it paid off. So, I was the technique was excellent, and stuff you can kind of only dream of. And that is the benefit of bringing Ebbs back in while he's still not 100%.
Definitely a real boon to the club, but I mean, as Bobby said, it was a real shame we didn't capitalize fully on that and really go for the jugular at 1-0 up. We again continued to invite a lot of pressure and sort of lapsed into the way we played throughout the game. I mean, I believe we had 22% possession for the entire game, which is incredibly low, particularly for a possession orientated Glasner system. And I think that's as much a testament to Spurs' own ability. I mean, you want to look at the likes of, Mateta being bullied by Van de Ven as just one of many flashpoints and key duels where it felt like we were totally out of our depth and really struggled in terms of actual quality man for man. But, there were some positives beyond that, say. I mean, Robbie, I know you were quite keen to talk about Sam Johnstone because, again, he seems to have reclaimed his number one spot and made some really, really important saves, not just the big one with Werner, which, of course, I'll let you talk about, but throughout the game, looked fairly comfortable. And if you'll forgive the cliche, it really could have been a cricket score without him. So, talk to me about him.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think he kept Palace in the game at times. I don't think Spurs did loads, don't get me wrong, but he made some pretty crucial saves at 0-0. That save from Werner definitely stands out. I mean, I think Werner goes too far personally, but even still, for Johnstone to shut down the angle as well as he did and make that save, it was pretty impressive. I thought he was superb in the game. I don't think he really put a foot wrong. Even though he conceded three goals, I think, as I say, if it wasn't for him, I think the scoreline could have been a lot bigger than it was. And I think you say it right. He reclaimed his number right one spot, and rightfully so. I mean, I don't think Henderson was ever really should have been in goal when Johnstone returned from injury, but that was the decision that was took. But I'm very pleased to see him back in the net for Palace and taking his rightful spot back.
Liam, just one thing. I mean, we obviously talked about the goals there. It's kind of a tough one for me. I was quite harsh at the time on Anderson. I was pretty disappointed in him at a personal level for someone who I actually do have a lot of time for, as both a player and a man. But he had a bit of a clang, didn't he? So talk to me about some of Anderson's mistakes in each of the goals that he was arguably at fault for, and just a bit about the fan reaction to him as well.
So yeah, I think the frustration with Anderson is, and I think Saturday was a really good example of it. It's the highs are so high, and those diagonal passes, they really catch the eye. So when he's playing well, it really stands out. But then you flip the coin, and his lows are really, really bad, like team destroyingly bad. When Mitchell has a bad game, it can kind of be covered, and maybe it's the it's being a centre back. It's the reality, but. I mean, he cost us the game on Saturday, really. There's no way around it. You can look at the huge substitution as well, maybe as a reason, but for the most part, it was his sort of 2 minutes of lunacy. And I think fan reaction's been interesting because I've been one to say that I don't think he is a leader in this squad. I think we saw it his time at Fulham that when the going gets tough, he's not someone you want to lean on. But his qualities as a centre back can't be denied when it's going well. So he's one that confuses me, and I think he's starting to divide the fan base a bit because, lots of people love him, and I can understand why. But the frustrations that come from a game like Saturday are really difficult to look past because, like I say, when I think things aren't going well, I do think he crumbles a bit.
It is really, cause for concern in terms of, some of his attitudes that we've seen lately, particularly in terms of squabbling with fans when the going gets tough. I think on the positive is the obvious passion line. He does play with his heart on his sleeve. He really, gives it his all in terms of, his vigor, his aggression. That's all quite strong. But I think in terms of, maybe maintaining calmness and collectiveness, it's an area where Gueye seems to partner quite well with him. I mean, both in terms of actual attributes on the pitch, in terms of their skills on the ball, both of them are sort of complementary to each other, which we've praised quite routinely, particularly earlier in the season when they seem to be at their best. But without Gueye, he kind of looks lost, Anderson, doesn't he? It's a really interesting one. Chris Richards had a strong performance, but unfortunately, I don't want to just talk about that just yet because one thing I did want to raise was the Daniel Munoz. Because Bobby, I know you had some choice words on him, but before I bring you in on this, Liam, I mean, did you think Munoz had a bit of a bad game?
Yeah, to be honest, I think he's been a mixed bag as well so far. I lean positive on him just because I think you can see the qualities he has and that will be beneficial, particularly in this system. But you got to call a spade. I think Saturday was a poor performance from him. That Werner goal, it was his man. He was nowhere near it. So I think he had a bad day. And I think he's one that I think we look at under Glasner and think, we really need him to sort of, we need Glasner to sort of grab him and mold him into the wing back that we need him to be because I think if he sort of stays like he is currently, it'll just be a stopgap between the next right back, which hopefully isn't Ward or Klein again. But there's definitely something there. But we need Glasner to improve him because it's too up and down at the moment. He's too sort of, you don't know what you're going to get going into a match day. And I thought against Spurs, he was poor for the most part.
I mean, I'm a bit softer on him. I mean, I think to be fair, against the quality of Spurs, you would expect him to struggle a bit more. But that being said, I don't think you say anything valid there. He's going to have these individual errors. He's going to have these weaknesses in his game that I think will be more exposed simply with the passing of time as we see more of him. I think we know his offensive qualities. I think, Everton and Burnley, he looked superb. But, there is an argument that that could be masking perhaps his some defensive frailties. And he is still adjusting, let's not forget, to this league in his defence. He is still very new to the ranks of the Premier League, and it's quite a step up from the Belgian First Division. Plenty of quality in Belgium, but I think it is a massive step up, and I think it will take time before he gets to his best. But if anyone can do that, I'm pretty sure it'll be Glasner. And Bobby, you're a bit harsher on him. Sorry, Liam, go on. I can see you want to go in there.
I was just going to say quickly, I think you're being very fair there in the sense that Saturday was a really difficult game, particularly for the wing backs, just because of the way Spurs play. They're so lethal in transition, and Werner, for all his faults, and he's a bit of a meme, and he's not the perfect player, but he is absolutely rapid, and he is quite intelligent with his movement, and he has been since he joined Spurs. So, Saturday was a particularly difficult game, which is why I haven't given up on him by any stretch. But, I think Saturday was a rough one for him. Like you say, there's context to it and there's reasons why.
Bobby, you're not so sold on him, are you? This is something I know you've mentioned.
Yeah, no, I'm not sold on him at all, if I'm being brutally honest. I think he's good going forward. Sometimes he can do a little bit too much for me. There was a against Spurs on Saturday, and I appreciate I'm picking out an isolated moment, but he ran from right back all the way down the wing and ended up at left wing, and then Spurs broke. Now everyone was excited about the fact he pressed so much and he had so much energy. But in actual fact, what it did, it was it put that Palace back line under a hell of a lot of a pressure. It was he does too much for me at times. He works hard, he runs a lot, and that kind of flatters the deceiver in a sense, because it makes him seem like he's doing more than he actually offers. But I will reserve my judgment until we've seen more of him, because admittedly, I don't think we've seen enough of him. And once Michael Olyse is playing on that right wing as well, because he's missing the Palace talisman who he would be setting up for chances or playing that ball down the wing. And so I am reserving judgment, but I'm just not quite sold on him yet.
Well, it's a good point there you make about Alize, actually, because we spoke before when we were kind of analysing the signing before it was done in what was actually quite a good January. And I still can't believe we had a January where we made a few decent signings. But anyway, we really looked at this idea of the overlap and how he would interact with that kind of winger role. Now, I think before Oliver Glasner was a bit more clear, I think we were looking at an out-and-out winger, whereas, it looks like Alize will play more in that kind of SA role, this kind of half-winger role that we've discussed. So a bit more of a 10 in a lot of ways, but still really interesting. I think the overlap's still going to be something that will apply quite heavily. So
Yeah, as I say, I have no problem with overlapping. I have no problem with high pressing fullbacks. But when you're making an extreme run from right back to left wing at a time where you really shouldn't be making an extreme run, you kind of sit back and think, whoa, what are you doing there? And I saw it in the ground and I was like, if Spurs get an out ball here, they're in. And you'd go 1-0 down. And it almost happened. It's his decision making, I think, is the word I've been looking for in this whole segment. Just not quite convinced on that. But he's adapting to the Premier League. Like I say, I give him the benefit of the doubt until I see horrific mistakes. But there's just little things about his game that I'm not quite keen on at the moment.
it's from the sublime to the ridiculous, isn't it, in terms of right backs. We've gone from Wardy, who won't leave his halfway line, rightfully so, because he hasn't got the pace to get back for God knows how long, to all of a sudden we're playing wing backs. And like you say, we got our right wing back going up to left wing trying to press.
I
Never has
say.
a position changed so dramatically in such a short period of time.
Yeah, and I don't think energy and pressing is everything when you're playing a right wing back role for Crystal Palace. I think it's a big part of it because that's part of the system. But I do also think you need that defensive awareness, that being sound defensively, if you like. And I'm not sure he is that. So it's certainly something in his game he's going to have to develop.
Well, we said about Mitchell last week with his discipline, whether he's playing left back or left wing back. And I think that's something that Munoz could sort of watch and learn from because, I don't think Mitchell had the greatest game on Saturday,
Yeah, he was disappointing on Saturday.
but I think in general, I think his decision making, when to go, when to stay, when to press,
Yeah,
when to
I agree.
not, I think that's much better than Munoz is at this point in time. And I think that's a credit to him, being the younger player.
Yeah, totally agree.
Definitely. Sorry, it was a really good distraction, so I wasn't going to get in the way of it. I'm kind of glad you guys sort of really talked that out. I wanted to raise just a bit of a shame of Jordan Ayew, a bit of a sad story. He obviously suffered an injury during that game. Bobby, what's the latest on the injury of Ayew?
Not entirely sure, to be honest. I haven't heard anything on that front. I think Glasner said in his post-match press conference that he should be okay. It was a bit of a hip problem that he felt in the first half. So as I say, there's been no update as of yet, and it's a waiting game whether he'll be available for Saturday or not. But the early signs from Glasner in that post-match press conference was that he would be okay.
That's good. I mean,
We've
it's at
really
least
missed him.
positive. So.
I actually thought he was dreadful on Saturday. I must admit, I thought even in that first half when he was okay before the injury, I don't think he offered much. I don't think he worked very hard. I thought he looked a bit disconnected from the game at time. I think he gave the ball away a lot. I wasn't impressed at all. I thought that right-hand side was a disaster.
I think it's interesting because I think what you just said about IU, I think it speaks to a wider issue with our front three on Saturday, which was nothing stuck, whether it went to Mateta, whether it went to IU, whether it went to Ebs, just as quickly as it went up, it was coming back. And I think that's
And this is,
something that's going to have to be looked at pretty intensely by Glasner,
I
because I
agree.
don't think when Elise comes back for all his quality, I don't think he's going to be someone that's going to improve our sort of ball retention. And that's so crucial under Glasner, and that's something that Mateta did really well against Burnley. And I think maybe we can look at it and go, okay, well, the individual quality of Van de Ven, of Tottenham's midfield. Van de Ven, by the way, what a player he is. I don't think I've seen a centre back that quick, maybe ever. So I guess you can cut him a bit of slack on that front, but regardless, I think that's going to be a serious sort of focus in training is, what we're going to do to retain the ball in the attacking spaces.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with what you said on the wider issue on the front three on Saturday. I actually thought, and I think this connects into something else, as in being Glasner's substitutions, because in that game, to me, it was glaring that when Edouard came on the left, it wasn't working. And then he stuck with Mateta up top, who I thought had a poor game by Mateta standards on Saturday. So what I thought he should have done is he should have brought in Edouard into the middle and then brought Ahamada on from Mateta, and then maybe that ball would have stuck a bit more up there because you've had the two cams, and then you would have had a striker who had a little bit of pace, hold the ball up a bit, and give Palace a bit more control in that final third. I thought Franca couldn't have any impact on the game because all the players around him weren't having any impact. They were either tired or they couldn't get into the game. So I think also, yes, there's a wider problem of the front three. You're right. And I also thought the decision making on Saturday in terms of the front three was poor from the manager.
Definitely plenty to forget, but plenty to learn. And of course, it is only Oliver Glasner's second full game in charge. I mean, Everton definitely was a bit different. He wasn't obviously in charge, but nonetheless, a change of a tactical style. So, there's a lot of transition still going on at the club, both on and off the pitch. And it will really be interesting to see how those lessons are taken forward, because I think, from a tactical standpoint, certainly, I think to come up against opposition like Spurs, who play a very expansive and progressive type of football, there's plenty to take away from that. It's not the first time we've come up against similar opposition who play in a similar way. So, really, really interested to see how we react there. But we can't dwell on Spurs forever. We've got Luton coming up. There's really important games. We've got Forest, West Ham in the mix. Loads and loads of really important fixtures. But I want to take a moment to look away from both Spurs and on the pitch affairs to discuss some really interesting quotes from Palace co-owner John Textor, who obviously owns a 40% stake in the club. He did a keynote interview at the Financial Times Business of Football Summit. And if you haven't checked it out already, I mean, please implore you to go and to quote yourself. But we'll obviously discuss some of the real key ones here. So, Bobby, I know you wanted to sort of take the lead on this one and really give your thoughts on this. So, just look at some key quotes and just give us your breakdown of what you made of it and his overall comments.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, actually. I did an article on it almost straight after his interview. I thought he'd come out with some super interesting quotes. There was praise for Parrish, which was very interesting considering the relationship that the press have insinuated is between the two. He really hit out at the Premier League's profit and sustainability regulations. The one that made me laugh is he kept calling them FFP when they're totally different rules, but that's probably just me being a bit of a geek. He also did that interview with BBC, which was quite quite damning, if you like, towards the fans, towards multi-club ownership, towards European football. He hit on quite a lot, and he provided a hell of a lot of value in his speeches. Some of the stuff I agree with, some of the stuff I didn't. Speaking to people in the room, to me, actually, it was quite interesting. It certainly seemed that from the quotes he was putting out, it was Textor wanting to take credit for everything that's going right at the football club, i.e. the Glasner appointment or other things like that. And then coming out with the fact that Steve Parish is running the day-to-day of the clubs, which obviously we all know is true, but he made that out like it was his choice that Steve Parish is running the club day-to-day, which is strictly not true. And it's almost like he's trying to seem that when things go right, it's him. He wants the credit for that. But when things go wrong, he can just brush that over to Steve Parish. So I thought they were quite telling quotes from him.
Absolutely. I mean, he definitely does a really good job of, breaking down the financial imbalance of power that we see in modern football at the moment. So I was really interested to see these punchy quotes, things like "That's not sport. Is anyone really having fun with this? It's broken." He was particularly critical of, and I know we don't think of ourselves as being part of a multi-club ownership model because we're not majority owned, but we are. And he made some really good points about the imbalance of power, particularly with the likes of the City Football Group, who obviously are pretty much state-owned by the UAE and own clubs from Mumbai to Melbourne, right through to Manchester. Nice triple M there, right? But
But
jokes
he
aside,
is right, and he is right, isn't he? What is the point of having billionaire owners if they can't spend their money to protect the elite six at the top? I mean, it's a fix in a sense. Don't get me wrong. I think if rules have been put in place, the rules have to be followed, and Forest do have to have their 6 points deduction. Everton need to have their 6 points and 6 points on top of that, so 12 point deduction because they're the rules. But it doesn't mean those rules are right, right? I think if a club, someone buys a club, I don't think they should be limited in any sense to what they can spend on that club, as long as they've got the financial proof that they can spend that money. Because
See,
otherwise, it becomes boring, right? It becomes that City win the league every year because they've got the commercial revenue, because they got it right when the rules weren't in place by putting slightly dodgy sponsorship deals in place and just pushing money into the club. But they bring the rules in, and now no one else can do that. No one can spend money, so no one can catch up. And it's just going to be the same ticks at the top every single year.
I disagree with elements of that, but the sort of the conclusion you got to, I agree with, is, I think these rules are clearly there because, the likes of Newcastle and everyone else that's got a bit of cash that aren't in that top six, they don't want the disruptors. But at the same time, I think there does have to be some sort of regulation because I think it's more boring if football just becomes most valuable owner wins. And I think if that was the case and there were no sort of rules in place, I think Newcastle would have gone out and done
But
everything completely
the most
differently.
valuable owners are already winning because they're the ones at the top. But they now all they've done is they've stopped anyone else from breaking into that category. Football is a game about money now. That's what the industry is. The game is about television deals, billions of pound owners. That's what the game is. Now, that's the direction the game has gone in. You may as well let it go to the full extreme and let people buy clubs and let people spend their money on it.
Playing devil's advocate here, and I know it's sacrilege to say, and I hate saying it, but using the scum down the road as the example, would they have had to have adapted and evolved in the way they have and become the club they have if it wasn't for those rules in place? Because in theory, what Tony Bloom could have done is just, okay, well, I've got X amount of money, I'm going to go out and spend X amount, and that's all I can do. But they went out and did it a different way and sort of went the data analysis route and sort of, they've done all that stuff, which frustratingly has made them so successful. Do you not view it perhaps, and I'm not sure I even agree with this, I'm just floating it as a question. Do you not think that the likes of Brighton and Palace and Brentford have had to evolve in order to sort of rise to these challenges?
Yeah, but why should they have to evolve if the teams at the top never had to evolve? I mean, if you've got the owners, if you've got someone who's bought the club for, so someone who's bought the club who's worth, so Tony Bloom, for example, he's worth £1.3 billion, right? Why I know that, I don't know, but go for it. Why should he not be able to use his money to build his club up when that's all Man City have done there, when that's all Chelsea did under Abramovich? But the rules were just different back then, so it made it easy. But now, because they've changed the rules, it doesn't matter because their commercial revenues are now through the roof because of what's already happened. So they're never going to fall down the tree. They're always going to be able to spend a hell of a lot more money than everyone else, even though everyone else has got the money.
I
I
mean,
mean,
Bobby.
whether you agree with Newcastle's ownership or not, is a totally different matter. But I don't think those rules should be in place to stop a club like Newcastle catching up. The owners are there now. The Premier League have deemed those owners that are fit and responsible to run a football club. So they should be allowed to spend their wealth, such as John Textor should be able to spend his wealth from Crystal Palace if that's so what he pleases to do. So, like I say, the game is about money now. You can't just put rules in place to keep the elite six controlling it. Let everyone control it. Let the 20 clubs in the Premier League have a wealth contest, because that's what the game is anyway. The top six at the top are the richest, and they're always going to dominate. So they may as well just make it an open tree and let everyone have a go.
Did that not end up being a zero-sum game, though, where basically everyone kind of spends themselves into the ground and causing massive inflation within an already distorted market? I mean, I think there's got to be some unintended consequences of that, right?
But what's the point, right? What is the point if your owner can't spend money on the football club? So Palace have got money to spend, right? But they can't spend it because of silly rules. How does that seem fair?
I mean, there certainly needs to be a review, doesn't there? A rework, because, you know,
it just keeps the same 10 teams in the bottom of the table every year and the same 10 teams in the top of the table every year. It's pointless.
I mean, people look at the Bundesliga as an example of a kind of reformed or more progressive league, but we actually have is more of a closed shop in terms of wealth, particularly with a reduced fixture schedule, particularly with, you know, the likes of, you know, your Leipzigs that sort of circumvent the 50 plus one rule, which doesn't feel fit for purpose, you know. There is a rich and a poor divide that is probably arguably even bigger by Germany's own standards, than ours. It's only going to go one way, it feels. And whether it's sort of in a model that's already existing within Europe, or whether it's kind of the existing course we're on, it feels like that financial imbalance is only going to get stronger and stronger. But I mean, the solution is, I mean, I really recommend people go listen to a podcast called The Price of Football podcast if they haven't already. I'm not afraid to plug another podcast. It does a really good analysis of some of the issues and some of the scenarios and why there's no such thing as a silver bullet at the moment. It is an incredibly messy situation, but one in which the immediate answers of making football both more sustainable and retaining its competitive integrity, I mean, it's going to be a bloody nightmare to crack. Look, there's a reason why the three of us sort of running our gobs online aren't accountants and lawyers and other sort of silver tongue, smart brain varieties, right? We're just here to sort of look at the quotes. But I mean, there's certainly a lot that can be said there in terms of some of the issues with the modern game. And invariably, I think whether it's Palace as part of Eagle Holdings, you know, and linked with the likes of Lyon and Botafogo, we're all part of this sort of global ecosystem. And there are going to be global consequences for, you know, any kind of regulatory or financial change in the future. So a really interesting one there. We won't obviously be able to unpack everything, but any, sorry, Bobby, if you've got some closing thoughts.
Yeah, something has to change, right? I don't think clubs can be penalised. Forest, for example, are the perfect example, right? Yes, Forest have broken the rules, but they have broken, and I do think this is a slightly flawed argument, but I buy the thought process. They have broken the rules to become sustainable, right? But the rules are called profit and sustainability. The rules in place would have sent Forest down. There's no secret about that. So it's not sustainability, is it? If you can't spend to stay in the Premier League, because that's what's going to make you the money, staying up. But it's going to send you straight down. So in actual fact, the rules are flawed in that sense.
If it's not chasing referees, I'm sure Mr. Marinakis at Forest can start chasing down some accountants as well. I mean, I'm sure he's going to be feeling the heat at the moment with what's going on in the news. And it's really interesting to see.
It's the difference in what... Because so the year in the championship that Forest had in this 3-year period, they were only allowed to spend, what was it, 15 million? Is it 15 million you can lose? And then 35 million you can lose in the Premier League? But so you can only lose 100 and whatever it is, 105 million in a year, and they lost...
Over a 3-year period,
but, yeah. So whatever, I can't think of the figures right now. Brain's not slightly with it. But they spent £3 million over the limit as if they were in the Premier League for 3 years. But because their values were so much smaller, because one of those years were in the championship, in actual fact, they've been allowed to spend so much less than the rest of the Premier League clubs. So the only reason they've spent that money, though, is to try and become sustainable, to try and stay in the Premier League and to try and build something of their football club. And what these rules do is teams coming up, it doesn't allow them to build. It doesn't allow them to try and stay in the Premier League because it limits them to who they can buy and what they can spend.
Definitely. I mean, it's a nice segue talking of building things back up, back towards Palace, because Crystal Palace have completed what feels like another milestone in a longer term project here. A bit of a move away from the finances, but thank you very much for your discussion, guys. But Palace have announced that Cheick Doucouré has signed a new long term contract with the club. And the 24-year-old has signed a new deal which runs until 2029, 5 years. No small contract there. Decore, he's joined to our fellow internationals in Abarieze, Michael Elise, Sam Johnston, and Jordan Ayew in committing themselves to the club. Many of those for the long term, with the exception of Ayew. So that's obviously age related as much as value related as well. But really, really positive news. I think everyone knows how outstanding that is. But Liam, just to bring you back in, I mean, Decore was elated, Parish was elated, fans were elated. I mean, how important is it that we time down to a new long-term contract? And particularly looking at the likes of, interest from Liverpool last summer, I mean, financially, what could the implications be of this?
It's crucial, man. It really is. I think with Decore, I think we and to be fair, the introduction of Wharton as well, I think we've almost forgotten how good he is. You know, this is one of the top three, maybe four players in our team, in our squad, and he's going to be so valuable once he comes back from injury. Touch wood, assuming that, he hasn't missed a beat. If he comes back the player he was, there's a reason the likes of Liverpool and stuff were interested in beforehand. And I think, this is really good news that I wasn't expecting personally. I'd sort of thought we'd done our business in terms of the contract side of things for the most part. I thought maybe we'd get some news on Gay, but I think this is really excellent news. And, Decore may well be, assuming there isn't a release clause in there, which Bobby will probably know more about. I haven't read anything about it. But this could really be the cash cow out of all our sort of assets.
Yeah, I don't think we've heard anything about a release clause. Bobby, have you heard anything of that nature?
It's not a conversation I've had. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I mean, you go back to things like Elise, release clauses weren't conversations anyone had, but they existed. So I say I can make some calls. I will make some calls at some point, but there's other stories going on that I'm focused on at the moment.
No, that's fair enough. But nonetheless, I think, as Liam perfectly outlined, they're very much a coveted asset and one that I think, whether he leaves in the summer for huge money, whether he's with us for the next 3 or 4 years, it's going to be massive either way. And I think full props to Dougie Friedman, who would have been involved on the front line, and obviously Parish and anyone else involved, because it's such a huge deal for the club.
I
We're
think
not
won't be going this
really.
summer.
No, he won't be going this summer then.
It
Fine.
won't be him this summer. It will be one of Anderson and Guy. I would say it would probably be Anderson, but who knows? And then it will be one of Elise or Eze. And you would hope it would be Eze. And I say that because if you just look at his age, if you look at what point of his career he's at, it's kind of the time to sell, if you like. Whereas Elise, one more year at the club, and you could be looking at a three-figure million kind of transfer fee.
Well, that's wishful thinking, but I mean, it's not impossible. I mean, I definitely think he could rotate with Rodrigo at Real Madrid. Honestly, that's another conversation. But thank you very much for your analysis. We are obviously not a preview podcast. We don't really do them. I think there's plenty of good coverage out there, but we do want to give a bit of a nod to Luton because, again, it feels like another 6 points coming up. I think Burnley was part of flying colours as a test for Oliver Glasner on his first game. But Luton, I think, is another huge test for him. Obviously, a massive fixture, probably the most likely candidate to occupy the 18th slot at the moment, but that doesn't include points deductions. That doesn't include all sorts of fixtures to come. I think in terms of relegation rivals, if we're still in that conversation, then Luton have to be probably target number one, I think, to send down for us. So really, really important we beat them. Liam, I'll bring you in on this. Are we still looking over our shoulders, do you think? Because it's something I hinted at just then.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'd be naive not to be honest. Because as we've seen with Luton away, one game and a couple bad injuries, and the whole world turns upside down. So I think until it's mathematical, I'm not going to relax personally. I'm 10 times more confident now we've made the managerial change. And I do expect us to play well and win against Luton, as I expect most people do. But I think it'd be silly to not be looking over his shoulder. I think most Palace fans, you guys included, I think all of us have it sort of ingrained in us that, expect the worst case scenario until the worst case scenario doesn't happen.
Definitely. Bobby, I mean, I quite like doing on it with score predictions last time. So I'll tell you what, I'll ask you for just some really, really quick thoughts before we close and just a quick score prediction.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very difficult game. I think I watched Luton this weekend, and they look very strong from set pieces, which Palace could is going to be Palace's biggest test under Glasner. so far in terms of set pieces. You know, they're a very strong side. They're good from corners, they're good from free kicks. I think it's going to be a tough game for Palace. I think they need to win. If they don't win, they're very much back in that relegation conversation. I might be a little bit reserved with my score prediction and say maybe 1-1 or maybe 2-1 Palace if I'm being super optimistic.
I was going to go 2-1 myself. I think it will be a kind of reversal of the previous fixture. I think it'll be very scrappy and physical. I think Luton are not to be scoffed at. I think we really underestimated them last time at Paper Price.
Yeah,
I
I
think.
think everyone thought going over there last time that Palace were going to roll them over, and it really wasn't that. And so if anyone thinks that this time, they'll be very naive. And you know, Palace have got a huge task on their hands here, and they must win. It will be difficult.
Yeah, definitely. I think the change of system will really help us. So I'm expecting more possession, better set pieces. I'm expecting more attacking threat overall, particularly with key players coming back. So I'm going to say 2-1. I think we'll probably concede from a set piece because, let's be honest, it's Palace. But I think going forward, and I think certainly on the ball, I think we'll be a lot more dominant than we were at Kenilworth Road. Liam, just one little soundbite. What scoreline are you going for?
See, I was going to say 2-1 as well, but I feel like that's being a bit of a cop out now. You guys have said it, so I think I'm going to go 1-0, clean sheet. I think, moment of brilliance from Eze maybe, but it's going to be a really tough game, like you guys say. But we need a good performance and we need a win. And I think this is actually a big game for Mateta.
I don't
We've
even
spoken
care
about.
about the performance, if I'm being brutally honest. As long as they win, really couldn't care. It's must win. That's all it is. You could play the worst 90 minutes of football in your life, but as long as you win, that's the most important thing in this game.
Definitely. Well, if you want us to come back and see us pie face like we were this week, you can do it all again next week when we look at the Luton result and a whole lot more. Liam and Bobby, thank you very much for joining me. Got to really wrap it up quickly here, but if you're not doing so already, make sure you're checking out thepalaceway.com for articles and a whole load more content. And if you're not following us on X already, please do so at The Palace Way, all one word. Really quick from me, guys. Thank you very much again for listening. And we'll see you after Luton. Stay safe, up the Palace, and thank you very much for your support. And of course, one little thing I seem to forget this time, leave a review. If you don't like the pod, tell us. If you love it, tell us. Everything's welcome. But other than that, thank you very much from all of us here at the Palace Way, and we'll see you in the next one. Thank you.